South Blue Stockings is collectively run, volunteer-powered organization. We have events like this, not exactly like this, obviously, but we have events every night around 7 o'clock. So, and if you're interested in future events, you can sign up on our email list over there. But because we are collectively run and volunteer-powered, we run solely on the kindness of folks like y'all. So we encourage you to hang around, buy some books, buy some of these lovely people up here right now. We also suggest a $5 donation for our events. We would never ask anyone to leave if you can't donate anything, but if you can donate more, that is also okay. And I guess I'll just let each of you introduce yourselves, okay? So, yay.
Hey, glad,
Totally loud?
Good, I was hoping for that. Thank all y'all for coming out to the event. So I'm just going to introduce the show that's up here right now and talk about our panelists. Since some of y'all might not have been at the opening of this show. We have a prisoner art show up on the walls right now, including art made on envelopes in the corner, a lot of which is sent to Books Through Bars, a group that sends books to prisoners, and then art that was sent to us by prisoners all along the front that you're more than welcome to check out after the panel. And I'd also like to encourage anybody who's here who can make it out to come back next week. On the 26th is our closing party, which will be really fun, and is also going to include a prisoner art auction. So most of the work that's up right now will be available for auction, and the starting bids will all go straight to the commissary of the prisoner who made the piece of art, so they can buy more art supplies and have money for paper and for stamps and for all their basic needs. And all the money above the starting bid is going to be donated to Solidarity with Pelican Bay Hunger Strikers, who were on hunger strike for better conditions in isolation units in Pelican Bay in California. So it would be really rad if anybody who is psyched about this panel today can make it out to the closing party and auction. And we're also going to be continuing to collect and put on shows of prisoner art in the future in New York and in other states to network together prisoner activists, prison activist allies, and prisoner artists. So if you happen to have any connections with people who might be in prison and producing art, please for sure get in touch with me. My name is Tallahassee, and you can just get all my contacts and let me know about how to get my hands on some of that art so we can display it and make those connections for people. Also, at the closing party, we'll have available prints of the pieces that are being sold at auction. So if you don't want to buy the piece itself at whatever auction, or if somebody else snaps it up and you really want a copy of the piece, you can get a print, and they'll be based on sliding scale, and all the money from the prints will go directly to the artist who made the piece. The design for the flyer for this show is available on silkscreen posters, and those are available sliding scale, $10 to $20, and all that money goes to support an anarchist prisoner in Richmond, Virginia, who's serving a year sentence on some totally bogus charges related to Copwatch. So that's what's going on outside of this panel, and now we have this panel happening with two representatives from STEPS who are totally amazing and can introduce their organization, and Jason from Black and Pink, and Vicky, who wrote a fantastic book about prisoner organizing and also publishes a zine called Tenacious of Writing by Women in Prison. So I'll just pass the mic down over to y'all and let you start.
Hello. So Michelle and I, my name is Josie White, and this is Michelle McGowan, and we're with Steps to End Family Violence. And particularly Steps to End Family Violence's Alternatives to Incarceration program. We work with women who've have criminal charges related to being victims of trauma. So you assaulted your abuser, you assaulted your pimp, you held drugs for your batterer, something along those lines. And we're doing a lot of advocacy and stuff in court around mitigation strategies, around narratives, and talking about what's up. So that's our program. And then about four or five years ago, we started doing kind of these events. The butterflies and the superheroes that you see up there, those are from our ladies up at the women's jail at Rikers. So all the women that we work with haven't been convicted yet. They've just been charged, but they're being held in jail because they can't afford bail or haven't been given bails, depending on the cases. And we do two events and then one family holiday party each year, and our events are very much around like trauma curriculum. Right now we're doing one called Bloom Strong, where we're talking about the inner child and talking about trauma and also talking about where, you know, you might have thrived as a child. And we're doing flowers and things like that, and that's a lot of like the art that's going on because it's a good way of talking about trauma. And then we have a big event. So this, our Mother's Day event is going to be on May 7th. And we do like a hot lunch. We bring in food from the outside. We bling out the jail as best as we can. So lots of pretty things. And this year it'll be lots of pretty flowers. And yeah, and then there's like a variety show. The women do poetry. They sing. They support one another. And yeah, it's a really good time.
Are we just doing an overview of our program first?
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, I apologize. Good evening. So excited to be hanging out with y'all in New York. I live in Boston. Black and Pink is an organization of LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, intersex identified folks who are locked up, as well as free world allies who may be part of our queer family or not. And we do a number of different projects. We have our primary piece is a monthly newsletter that goes to 1,300 LGBTQ prisoners across the country of prisoner created writing, which are stories of survival, stories of abuse, stories of legal suggestions, poetry from amazing, most beautiful poetry you've ever read, some of the most mediocre poetry you've ever read, but it's all so important as this part of survival. And that's the thing that's so, I think, incredible about it. We also share some political analysis building and world news and random pieces, as well as like crossword puzzles and little entertainment as we can. In this newsletter, and try to use it as an organizing tool to share information so prisoners at different prisons across the country can know what are other LGBTQ folks going through while they're locked up, and how do we figure out what a strategy is to survive where we are. It's also pretty amazing that people who are closeted, maybe where they're locked up, someone else will see that they're getting the Black and Pink newsletter, and they're like, I get the Black and Pink newsletter, and then they know about each other. We've heard of a few stories like that, and so that's been an exciting piece of prisoner-based organizing being just different, I think, than a lot of outside organizing. And so that's a big piece of what we do. Another part, we have a pen pal program. Nearly all 1,300 prisoners are looking for people to write to them, and so their names are listed on blackandpink.org. So we can go there and get pen pals and build relationships, get to know people. And then we do an art program as well. About 125 prisoners contribute to our art program, and we sell their art both online, but really at events more so than is actually bought online. We had things on Etsy, but Etsy has chosen to say that you can't sell prisoner art because it has to be sold by the individual, not by proxy. So since prisoners don't have access to something like Etsy, they're excluded from Etsy. That said, I think really they kicked us off because there are people who are convicted of some pretty terrible things who were making art, and people complained that we were selling child molester art. And we were. People who are inside, some people have done some things that are terrible and still need our support on the outside. And so there's just a lot of different pieces to the work that we have going on, and then do direct advocacy and support for people who are locked up while connecting with people across the country to really build the power of solidarity work on our end.
Hey, my name is Vicky. I'm actually not here representing an organization per se. I do a lot of work with women in prison across the country. I do a zine called Tenacious Art and Writings by Women in Prison, and as Jason pointed out, it's so important to have these kinds of like outlets and forums for them to express themselves and for them to share their stories and experiences, not just with people on the outside who often don't hear about what goes on inside women's prisons, but often with each other too, so they can see that these are systematic problems, that it's not just like one bad apple or just happening to them. And then they can also see how other people are coping with this or surviving with these kinds of injustices, and also what resources are available or what actions other people have taken. I also, so I do a lot of work with women inside, direct work, which is like writing letters, finding out what they need, looking up cases if they need to, you know, and doing what I can. I also work with two groups, Books Through Bars, New York City, which sends free books to people inside prisons nationwide, and that's hugely important when you look at the fact that so many people who are in prison are the people who are least likely to have been able to go to college or even have a high school diploma or a GED. There's no mandate that says that, that prisons have to have libraries or access to books for the people inside prisons. New York State has a mandate that prisoners have to have libraries, but no other state does. And so it's really important to sort of break through that isolation and like even just give somebody a book to like break up the monotony of being locked in their cell all day or break up the prison monotony. And I also work with another group called WORK, Women on the Rise Telling Her Story, which is a group of currently and formerly incarcerated women operates out of New York City, and it works with women across New York State who've been impacted by incarceration. And I work with their sister circle, which is a group of women who have not been incarcerated but are willing to like lend their talents and strengths and take leadership from the women who've been directly impacted to help like build the organization and strengthen women's voices.
So on that note, and thanks all for taking all your groups so well, I'm going to let you start by just sort of
Any questions in particular or just at the cuff?
If you'd like to talk about how the prison system specifically impacts like women and trans people, and the specific way that the prison system like targets those individuals impacts the organizing and the response of those people to the prison system.
Okay, there's a lot there. Well, basically, I can say like certainly. I mean, STEPS got started, and we started in 85, and we were founded by a nun who basically had done a lot of work in prisons, and a lot of the work that's been done in prisons nationwide has been done by clergy because they were the ones who had access to folks who were incarcerated. So she was doing work out at Bedford, which is the maximum security women's prison upstate, and had found out she was working with a lot of women and found out that she kept hearing the story over and over and over again that the women who were in for homicide charges were in for homicide charges for killing their abusers and hadn't had a lot of the information presented in court. And so there was a hearing where she basically presented, and 9 women got up and told their stories. And from that, our Alternatives to Incarceration program was born, really small and growing from that point. In general, you're going to find, like, I can speak directly about women since that's who I work with, but the statistics are terrible. I mean, they really are terrible. It's, you know, depending on the different study, it's going to say 60 to 90% of women who are incarcerated have been victims of domestic violence, have been victims of incest, have been victims of child abuse. And after working at Roseanne Singer Center, the women's jail here at Rikers Island, I would say that that's probably closer to like 99%. Like, you just hear the trauma story is such a, like, that's a big part of, you know, it's really like, you know, when resources have broken down, when things aren't there, that's when people are being incarcerated. And it has, and specifically with Rikers, you can say that it's women of color. Like, those are the ones that are being held without bail. Those are the ones that are being charged with some of the, like, bogus charges, who are being held on things where they want them to testify against their batter, and the way they're doing it is they're being strong-armed to do so. So, I mean, It's pretty crazy, and it's been hard for us because we're doing this program where we're trying to advocate in court, and so we're like trying to tell people stories. And when we first started doing groups at jail, it was kind of on the like down low and really, really like covert. I mean, to get into doing any kind of programming in jail is super hard.
Yeah,
it's really hard. And so we kind of like just barely got in. We're like, we're going to do domestic violence groups. So we like came in, and this was like 2007. We're like, all right, we're going to do these domestic violence groups, and you just hear, and you hear the terrible stories, everything that's going on. And then it's not necessarily that safe to be talking about that while you're at jail, because people haven't been convicted for anything yet. So people's details about stuff can come out. Someone can call an ADA. There could be... So we couldn't really be talking about. So then we had to like kind of take a step back and think about how people could speak without telling their stories directly. So art, poetry, all the ways that people are speaking anyways became really important. So then we like backtracked and we're like, okay, we're going to speak through metaphors. So we're going to have superheroes. We're going to have butterflies. That was our metamorphosis event. You know, we're going to talk about it like that. And then what's been really interesting is, so we got in all like sneaky, and then we were like, hey, we're going to have these events. And they're like, whatever, you know. So then we start like doing our thing that. And Mother's Day last year, we managed to get noticed by like the, you know, corrections, like higher up corrections staff, like programs for the entire island of Rikers Island. And suddenly we needed a sponsor, and suddenly we needed to be a lot more censored. And in general, they want to know what you're doing, what's happening.
How much good food you're bringing in.
Yeah, and when you are doing something that's really nice, because it is really important to us that our events, it doesn't look like jail. That when we're coming in and we're doing a Mother's Day event, that the visit house looks so beautiful, and that we have flyers that are really, you know, about, they're going to convey that this is a cool party that you want to come to. And it's not, you know, because you do have to maintain. It is about keeping on and keeping on. And that's how you can survive jail, is to have something to look forward to, something to do, some people to feel connected to.
And Josie's worked really hard to get not just the ladies to be able to come down, but also their families come to some of the events. And for a lot of women, they don't want their children to come and see them incarcerated. So that could be an event maybe where they would feel comfortable, because it doesn't look like jail. It's decorated really nice.
Yeah, like it could be. It's pretty.
With the decorations that the women made mostly.
Yeah, yeah. It's a big part of like creating it and making it an event, and making it so that there is some solidarity, that there is support. Women can be there for each other, but they oftentimes aren't. Like, we oftentimes are like, backbiting, all the different stuff that happens. And especially when you all live, you know, you live in a unit with all these women, and different things are going on, and different people are going through different stuff, and it can be like a lot of drama. So, yeah, so it's been interesting, and this year has been particularly difficult because we've been under a lot of scrutiny, and so now we have to be accountable to DOC, and there's a real feeling, or DOC being the Department of Corrections, there's a real feeling of, like, at any point, because our program, all of our Rikers programming is unfunded, we just did it because it needed to be done, you're there, you see the need, you do it, but then you don't have anything to stand on. Like, we're not mandated to be out at the island, so at any point that they decide that we're a security issue, we're out. And so there's this weird, like, line you have to walk where, and it's really hard. And when we have new interns and stuff come in every year, like through social workers, I'm a social worker. So when you're talking to the interns, I mean, they're all, you know, and they see the way the women are treated by COs. They see the way the COs treat them. They, you know, and you could speak to this really well, Michelle. Like, you have all those experiences, and you have to walk this fine line where you don't piss anybody off, right? Where you're being able, so that you can keep your programming, because it's so important. Yeah, so it's been really interesting, and in fact, Michelle's done, like, it would be good to have you talk about a lot of, like, kind of, like, passive, in-the-background projects that you can do that are active, like, organizing, talking about sending in the feminist books, like, going through, like, even the spa day stuff is pretty good.
Well,
the lotion stuff.
Is it okay? Can you guys hear me if I just talk really loud?
Sure.
The microphone makes me nervous. I'm not going to give away all the secrets just in case, you know. But we definitely had to do some sort of undercover things, just trying to get in, like, something as simple as lotion or what, you know, products that might make you feel nice while you're in jail that you can't have. We had spa day, so it could bring in, like, aromatherapy type stuff, but recently we started a book project, which is called Empower Rikers Residents, and the idea was that it was getting expensive to just have all the books
coming out of pocket that the ladies wanted to read, and once they found out that they could get the ones that they were requesting, not just, like, there's, like, a lot of love stories that are nice, I'm sure, but, you know, like, trashy love novels, that was, like, everything that they had in there.
Right.
And then they're asking for, like, Angela Davis, they're asking for more radical authors that aren't likely to be sent through there, and talking about how difficult it was to get them. So, like, that project has been really good for communicating with the outside, because then they're writing thank you notes and they're writing letters back and forth. And that had to be kind of sneaky. The only reason it got blown up was because the paper got a hold of it, which actually made it a great project, but the ladies were like, we love Angela Davis. Yeah, so
it's hard. Is at any point that you get any media attention, then the Department of Corrections knows what's up, and they know what you're doing, and then suddenly, yeah, there's more scrutiny. There's just more. So it's hard. It's hard because the more organized, the more, the bigger the events we do, the nicer it is. Like when we had, for the Metamorphosis was what our butterfly event was, where we had like all the butterflies hanging from the ceiling, and we had like butterflies all over the place. And it was so beautiful, and the women loved it. And we got that event shut down within like an hour. Like it was so hard because you worked so hard on getting everything in. The women had worked so hard on all of their art, and when that happens, it just happens, and it's so heartbreaking because you can't do anything about it. And suddenly, it's over. Like they want you off because it's too nice. You know, like it's too nice. It doesn't look like jail. We're not punishing people enough.
Just to answer a question. Part of your question, I think, mm-hmm. or talk about it anyway, is the way that like gay, lesbian, bi, transgender, the whole list of whatever your, you know, sexuality or gender identity is, the girls that are coming through there, a lot of them are kicked out of the house when they're younger because their parents aren't okay with the people they choose to be with. And you see, especially in working with the adolescents, we've been doing a dance group recently, they're mostly, I would say the majority of them were kicked out of the house because of the relationships that they had, and they turned to sex work, or, it's controversial because they're kids, and they're making choices, and then they have to go to jail. And when you look at it, just like creating a space to be like, it's okay, the choices that you made, and just providing another perspective besides you were bad, you were punished, now you're here, has been really nice, because it's refreshing to hear them talk to each other. And you think, like, you know, at first I was like, okay, guys, so we're going to sit down and talk. And they're like, nah, let's exercise. And I'm like, okay, so we do our dance group. And it was like, I didn't even bring it up again. And then it was just straight dance group. And the other day I came in and they're like, oh, hey, so we were wondering about da 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 da. And it turns into a dialogue just out of nowhere. So that's been really exciting. Sneak attack.
Yeah, well, and part of, like, what is... like, you know, the sneak attack, the frustrating, is that there's just not a lot of programming at Rikers. There's not a lot of programming at the jail level. And there's more programming at the prison level upstate. And so, and this is, I believe, part of all the, like, craziness of the system. Because if everyone is super bored when they're at Rikers, there's nothing to do, there's not a lot going on, if you take pleas, like, everyone talks about prison, like, you know, oh, I'm just going to go upstate because I can smoke, I can actually, you know, do education, like, you know, whatever, I mean, this is a bullshit charge I have, but, you know, I'm just going to take the 5 years and do it because it's better than being here at Rikers, I'm sick of this nonsense, right? And that's the part where it's so frustrating, because then when people take pleas that they don't need to take or shouldn't have to take, and then the system isn't being, like, no one's going reflecting on how they got arrested in the first place. There's no questioning about what happened with the officers or was it particularly shady the way that all went down. Like, when someone takes a plea, no one looks into it, right? So it's just like, oh, yeah, and they took a plea. And so, yeah, it gets really frustrating, especially for when we do all this legal advocacy work, because you watch it and you see people take stuff that they shouldn't take or don't deserve to take just because they want to get out of there. Just want to get out of there. They want to be able to, like, you know, have something to do, be able to cook their own food, not have to eat the craziness. The thing about Rikers with women, we call it like the Rosie 30, and sometimes it's a lot more than that. The women put on a lot of weight when you come into jail because the food is terrible. The food is terrible. It's like... mostly everybody's eating white bread. The stuff that you can get in commissary is like chips,
Ketchup,
right. Like, I mean, it's just, it's terrible. And women, anyways, the way we, when we get stressed, we store our weight, you know, it all comes on. So women put on tons and tons of weight while they're at Rosie, and they have, the rec is a cement quad in the middle of the jail. So you can, when you want to work out, you can walk in a square. Like, that is what that looks like. There's not, like, weight rooms. There's not weight equipment. I mean, it's really sparse at the jail level. Whereas upstate, there's, like, more you can do. People get in shape, that kind of thing. So, yeah, women put on a lot of weight. That affects their court cases because the more weight they put on, the more aggro they look, the more aggressive it is. Suddenly they could be a menace. So it's like, yeah, it's all that nonsense. I don't think if there's anything else really important we want to say.
We'll rant to you in a minute.
Yeah, there'll probably be other rants. Just to sort of say about our Mother's Day event that's coming up. So on May 7th, if anyone is interested, we are definitely looking for people to cook food. Like, home-cooked food is really exciting and really interesting and good for all the ladies. And so we need food. And so if anyone interested in donating some home-cooked food, or if you don't want to cook and you want to just, like, get $20 so we can buy some chicken and some stuff, that's really useful. We also have a craft day that we're doing next Saturday, which is the 28th. Which is basically where we do a lot of the crafts that we're going to have at the event, where we make it real pretty. So anyone can come out and make flowers with us. We're going to have a lot of our women who are formerly incarcerated and have been working with us on the outside be out and doing crafts, as well as other, like, allies who want to come in and, you know, get down with some flowers so that we can really, like, turn the jail out. So, yeah, just if you're interested, come and talk to me later.
Sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I want to piggyback on a few things that y'all said in terms of parallels and connection with LGBTQ communities who are impacted by incarceration. But first, I wanted to ask, just in case people saw recently, the New York Times had a piece that looked at the number of people and the percentage of who are taking plea deals. Did anyone see that? What percentage, you can just shout it out if you want, of people do you think go into court, take a plea deal instead of going to trial? What percentage?
75.
60, 75, 90. Right? 95% is what is reported. So 95% of people plead guilty to something or get a continuance without a finding or some other aspect. 95%. And that is because of things like these crazy laws, right? It's the mandatory minimums, the three strikes pieces, where prosecutors are given all of this opportunity to charge someone with a litany of offenses for one or two particular incidences that have happened. And so then they're able to threaten this enormous amount of time. And then what they'll do is they'll say, well, I'll drop this charge, I'll drop this charge, and I'll drop this charge if you'll plea out to this. And so if you think about who has support on the outside, first of all, think about policing, right? So the reality of policing is that people of color and poor communities and that folks who are gender nonconforming, queer and trans, are disproportionately impacted by police violence, police harassment, and, you know, the stop and frisk. There's an epidemic here in New York City, but really around the country, a lot of attention is being given here to the realities of black and brown young folks being targeted by the New York City Police Department. In my city, in Boston, we have a huge problem with that, too. We're consistently, youth and youth of color and queer youth of color are constantly being put up against the wall, patted down, assaulted, really, by police officers. And then they are then pushed and railroaded into the criminal justice system and then are forced to be part of this 95% of people who are pleading out whether they did anything or not. So one of the key aspects around all of this is that every one of us has broken the law, guarantee it. Every single one of us is part of the deal of just the reality of how laws get passed, what they're doing, and that the people who are getting locked up are the ones who the system is going after and who the system is targeting. So Black and Pink, as an organization, we consider ourselves abolitionists, that we do not believe we can reform or fix the system, but that the system itself is functioning perfectly. The system itself is functioning to incarcerate Black and brown people, poor people, queer and trans folks, and that it does that very, very well. It surveils people, goes after people, tracks people. And so what we want to do instead is figure out, how do we take bricks away from the system? What are abolitionist reforms, non-reformist reforms, whatever you want to call them, what are ways we can plug in to the system and help subvert it to tear it down, so that we're not doing anything that we're going to have to abolish later, that we want to create things and be part of processes that are subverting the system, are being led by those who are most impacted by the violence of the prison-industrial complex, and that are then going to actually help us in the movement to dismantle it. So that's kind of the framework that we come out of. Also wanting to piggyback on the aspects around talking about sex work and young people and queer young folks, queer again, the interconnections of white supremacy, capitalism, heteropatriarchy, are key for all of this. We have to have a deep and complex understanding of the interconnectedness of all of these identities and these systems of oppression that are what are really the building blocks of these institutions, from the police to the judges to the legislators who created the laws to the prisons themselves and probation officers, parole officers, that the system is so multifaceted that trying to take on piece by piece can be exhausting. For sure. But that is about finding pieces to take on. And that is what Black and Pink is encouraging folks to do. And what I think this panel is about encouraging folks to do is to help build opportunity for people to plug in and be part of this abolitionist efforts that will get us to a place where we aren't living in a world that has prisons or police, but that we're creating something different. Again, to piggyback what I was trying to say on the sex work piece, here in New York, you all have a great opportunity right now. Condoms are used as evidence when arresting an individual, as evidence for sex work. So if you have more than two condoms on you, that can be used as evidence against you that you were taking part in criminal activity of prostitution. So you have a piece of legislation right now in your state house that is trying to stop that. And it is a key piece of legislation for impacting the lives specifically of trans women of color who are over and over and over again stopped for sex work, whether they are sex workers or not. And if you have two or more condoms on you, whether you were picking up tricks for your survival or not, you can still be prosecuted. So regardless of how you feel about sex work, whether that if decriminalizing sex work is something that you believe is important or not, the reality is the criminalization of safer sex and safer sex practices, and how that then impacts trans women of color in particular, needs to be at the forefront of some of this work. That understanding the realities of HIV and AIDS and how that's impacting poor and communities of color and trans and queer communities and its interconnectedness with the prison industrial complex is one of the things that I'm just beginning to learn more about, I will say. Most recent statistics say that 1 in 4 HIV-positive people will experience incarceration at some point during their lives. That's outrageous. So the realities of who is incarcerated in healthcare and what we are talking about in terms of people's survival needs to include an analysis of HIV needs and needs to include care and empowerment for people who are living with HIV and AIDS. And there are amazing organizations both here in New York and around the country who are really trying to do that work and who are bringing with them an understanding that the prison system itself is perpetuating the spread of the virus and is perpetuating these things by not providing things like condoms for people who are inside, by not doing needle exchange for people who are inside. They tried it in Canada, it was going beautifully, and then they got rid of it. It has never been even tried here in the United States. But needle exchange is a direct life-saving action. And so if you're thinking about things, what are things we should be doing? How do we be support to LGBTQ folks, to women who are incarcerated? These are some of you can work on campaigns that are connected to the survival of people who are locked up. And that's one of the things that Black and Pink is really trying to do, is figure out what are survival strategies that people are using, and how do we support them in maintaining and continuing those survival strategies? And so that's why our newsletter, I think, is so important for helping and supporting folks who are locked up communicating with each other about what their survival strategies are. Having a trans woman tell her story of sexual violence and being brutally abused by either another prisoner or by prison guards, which is more common, and then to have that printed and another person to see it, and then write back a letter to our newsletter that says, hang in there. This is how I hung in there. Here's how you can do things in your own cell. Here's how, when you close your eyes, think about this. When you are locked up and you can't look in a mirror, when you can't control the lights because the lights are controlled by someone else, right? So all the sexual assault work on the outside of prison is often, well, do this, or go for a walk, get away from where you are. That's not a reality for survivors of sexual violence who are locked up. I would say it's always a reality for people who are on the outside, but we need to be able to address the needs of people who are incarcerated and the specific realities of being locked up. And so who can do that best is other people who are locked up, because they know best how to do the survival. And that's what our newsletter really tries to be. And then the pen pal piece, again, for folks who are locked up, if you are LGBTQ, person of color, poor, who doesn't have a lot of support on the outside, it is likely that you are not getting any mail. Maybe you're getting one piece here, one piece there, over the course of a year, but it's not consistent mail. And people know this when you're not getting noticed, right? So mail call regularly happens in a public space, happens either in the day room or happens down the hall, and people can hear your name getting called out or not getting called out. And if your name is never called out, people know there's no one looking out for you. There's no one who's going to do anything if I fuck with you. Guards know that, and other prisoners know that. And so our newsletter functions as an opportunity to have someone's name called out, and it's a harm reduction tool. I like to think of getting mail, if you can think of it as a harm reduction tool, it can be really useful for thinking, I don't have time to write today, I don't have time to get this done. That is the survival strategy that you can encourage and be part of. That people getting and receiving mail, if it's a postcard, like a 5 words, just want to let you know, you're not forgotten. XOXO, Jason. That these things then are being heard around where this person's incarcerated, and they know that if you fuck with them, we're coming for you. There will be consequences for their prison. We will be phone calling in because we're looking out for each other. And then also, the realities of suicidality and self-harm are huge in prison. Massachusetts actually, this past 2 years ago now, had the highest rates of suicide ever documented in the history of the U.S. prison system. It is outrageous. People are taking their lives because there's just no hope. In our system in Massachusetts, we are creating, we're actually trying to pass a new three strikes law in Massachusetts, completely regressive. Our parole board is refusing to let anybody out. It's a really scary time. And that leads to more hopelessness. And if people aren't being heard from folks on the outside, if they don't know that they're being cared about, if they don't know people are thinking of them, that hopelessness is even greater. And so doing the letter writing is a big piece of supporting people's own personal mental health so that they know they're not forgotten, so that they know that they're part of something, that there is a continuation of their lives, that there is a world that's happening outside of the prison, and that they are connected to that. And that their experience inside of the prison is being heard by people on the outside, and we're doing something about it. Even if it's simply making a phone call, having a dinner with somebody else, and talking about it, that there is witnessing happening. You're talking about the role of clergy. For myself as an ordained clergy person, this is a lot about my faith. And I think it's a lot for a lot of people about their faith that calls them to do this work. So when you're thinking about LGBTQ folks, if you can remember to include us in the anti-prison movement, that is really key. We're left out over and over and over again. Like, women are left out over and over and over again. We really need to remember to bring in this interconnected aspects of identity when Pride happened, reminding folks that all of the Pride marches in the 70s went by the jails here in New York, that they were outside, especially women's jails, and there was fists on the windows and people shouting back and forth because there was an identity within the queer movement that we understand that the prison struggle is a queer struggle and a queer struggle is a prisoner struggle. And so we need to bring that back to life as much as we possibly can. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you. And I don't know how I sort of like go after such an inspiring, rousing talk. So I'm going to bring people back a little bit in time to look at what people in prison have done in terms of organizing and resisting, and also what people on the outside have done to like help support them, but also realizing that they really need to take the leadership from the people inside and not come from this, you know, we're coming from the outside, we know what's best. So before I start, I just want to pose two quick questions to you. Just by a show of hands, how many of you have heard of the Attica Rebellion? All right. Now, how many of you have heard of the August Rebellion? Okay, it doesn't count if you've read my book. All right. So just to give brief summaries of both, the Attica Rebellion happened at the maximum security prison for men in Attica, New York, in this very state, in September of 1971. The people in Attica rose up and they took over portions of the prison and they took 38 staff members hostage and issued a series of demands for reform. At the time, you know, Attica was, like many of the prisons, was a brutal, you know, cesspool, basically. But they issued demands for a reform, like they wanted an end to the racist brutality by the prison staff. Then, as now, most of the prison staff was white and most of the people in the being incarcerated in the prison were black or brown. They wanted better education programs and better vocational programs. This was before, you know, there were college and prison programs. This was before, like, there were a lot of educational opportunities. They wanted an end to the awful working conditions in which many of the men had to work in the prison's metal shops. And at times, the temperatures would rise to over 100 degrees inside, and they were forced to keep working. And they basically wanted to be treated like human beings, like not as something like it's like less than dirt. And they asked then-Governor Nelson Rockefeller, who, you know, passed the Rockefeller drug laws, our first mandatory minimum sentencing in this country, to meet with them about their demands for reform. And instead of meeting with them, like, say, any rational person would do, he sent in the National Guard, which fired tear gas into one of the yards where many of the men and their hostages were standing, and then fired indiscriminately through the smoke so they couldn't see what they were firing at. And they killed 31 prisoners and 9 guards and injured hundreds of others. And I bring up Attica because this was like a turning point in like inside-outside relationships. People who were working around social justice issues on the outside, working around black liberation, around Chicano liberation, you know, gay liberation, you know, women's lib, education, housing, et cetera, realized that what people were experiencing inside prison was just a gross exaggeration of what they were fighting against on the outside, and they started making connections and supporting people inside. So fast forward 3 years later to 1974, at the Bedford Hills Correctional Facility for Women, which is about an hour and a half from here. So it's in Westchester County. It's the maximum security women's prison. In August, 5 male guards beat a woman named Carol Crooks and placed her in solitary confinement without any sort of hearing. The month before that, Carol Crooks had actually won a court order stating that the prison had to give women due process before placing them in solitary confinement. So they actually had to, you know, tell them what they're charged with, tell them, like, give them the right to hearing, have them be able to rebut these accusations before placing them in 24-hour, you know, 24-hour cage, basically. So this was clearly retaliation for the fact that Carol Crooks had won a court victory. And this might have ended there, except that the women around her said, you know what, enough is enough. And they rose up, and they took over portions of the prison, and they held 7 staff members hostage, and held onto the prison until guards from neighboring male prisons and male state troopers were called in to retake the prison. And in the retaking of the prison, 25 women were injured, and 24 women were later transferred to the Mateo 1 complex for the criminally insane, again without any sort of required hearings. But one of the things that happened was that people in the women's communities and lesbian communities at the time saw that rebellion and said, you know what, we need to support our sisters inside. And so kind of like Attica, you know, it touched off, you know, a lot of support for women inside. So they started writing to them, they started reporting on prison conditions, they started helping them get their stories out there. And I bring up these two because while we remember Attica, there's books about Attica, there are documentaries about Attica, you know, it's mentioned in any sort of book about prison uprisings and prison rebellions and resistance. Today, even though there was a movement to support the women in Bedford Hills and there were women who were galvanized by the August Rebellion, almost nobody remembers it. So why is there this invisibility around the actions that women themselves have taken, especially something as like splashy as a riot? And I want to go a little further back in time, just to like illustrate this sort of invisibility of like women's actions, to 1954 in North Carolina, where there was a young black woman named Eleanor Rush who was incarcerated in the capital of Raleigh. She was in the North Carolina women's prison, and she was placed in solitary confinement. On the seventh day in solitary confinement, the guards, for some reason, decided they weren't going to feed her. And after 16 hours of no food and no water, she started yelling through her cell door that she was hungry and she wanted food. And instead of coming to bring her food, the guards came and they bound and they gagged her. And they dislocated her neck in the process. And half an hour later, Eleanor Rush was dead. And again, this might have just ended there, except that the next morning, when the women who weren't in solitary confinement, who were allowed some sort of movement, were out in the yard to, like, you know, be in the sun, see their friends, talk to each other, another woman from the solitary confinement unit yelled down to them and said, Eleanor Rush is dead, the staff is responsible. And the women in the yard surrounded the staff members and said, you know, we want answers. We want to know, how did she die? What happened? Who's responsible? And again, given this is 1954 in North Carolina, why did the body of this young black woman get sent to the all-white hospital for an autopsy? Like, we know that you're covering something up. And when they didn't get the answers they wanted, they just rioted. And they rioted for 3.5 hours. And again, it wasn't the prison staff that was able to quell the riot. They actually had to call in guards from the neighboring male prison and other men from the area to come and subdue the riot. But as a result, because the women rioted, the State Bureau of Investigation ordered a probe into Eleanor Rush's death. They weren't buying the prison's explanation that somehow, while bound and gagged, Eleanor Rush dislocated her own neck and committed suicide. That was the official explanation. The state prison's director was forced to explicitly ban the use of gagging, and he was also forced to ban the use of another device called the iron claw, which were metal handcuffs that squeezed really tightly when applied. Again, like, you know, these are things that happened because they were forced to, not because somebody from the, you know, from higher up said, oh, we shouldn't use these anymore. Okay. The prison was required to pay $3,000 to Eleanor Rush's mother. And again, this doesn't bring Eleanor Rush back to her mother. It doesn't make up for the fact that they murdered her child. But keep in mind that one of the ways that you can make systems like prisons accountable is you make them open up their wallet and actually have to pay and acknowledge that, you know, like, they did actually do some atrocity. And also keep in mind that at that time, $3,000 was more than half the yearly salary of the prison warden. So that was actually a lot of money for them to have to pay, you know, for this, you know, for basically killing this young black woman. And the prison superintendent was replaced with a woman from a social service agency. So it was a shift from this idea that women were this irredeemable, unrehabilitatable population to, like, looking at, well, what can be done to prepare them for outside. Not abolitionist by any stretch, but, you know, it was a change from punish, 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 punish to, like, let's start looking at women as people and what can we do for them. So I want to pause here to pose a question to you, which is, what do you think about when you think about women in prison? I mean, you've heard from the people from Steps, you've heard from Jason, you know, what do you think about, like, if I say women in prison, what issues come to mind? We to just call them out.
Lack of child care.
Lack of child care. The majority of women in prison are mothers, mostly mothers to children under the age of 18. How many of you have heard of the Federal Adoption and Safe Families Act? Really? Okay. In 1997, Congress passed the Federal Adoption and Safe Families Act, which states that if a child is in foster care for 15 of the past 22 months, the state has to automatically start terminating parental rights. And those rights, once they're terminated, they're gone. You don't get them back if you get out tomorrow, the next week, the next month. They're just gone. And only at the time, only two states actually had exceptions for if the child was in foster care because the parent was in prison. And New York State, in 2010, became the third state. So that leaves 47 other states that basically say if your child is in foster care because you're serving some sort of long mandatory sentence, or even you've pled out and you're, like, serving a two-year sentence, After 15 months, forget it. You no longer legally have a child, and you have no more rights to that child than the stranger in the grocery store does. And this is particularly impacting women because when a father goes to prison, oftentimes somebody, you know, some female relative will take care of his child or children, whereas when a mother goes to prison, oftentimes she's either already a single head of household, or her partner is arrested alongside of her, or her partner is like, I can't do this, and there's not the same family support because of the way we gender parenting that there is. And so a child of an incarcerated mother is 5 times more likely to end up in foster care than the child of an incarcerated father. Other issues that come to mind when you think about women in prison?
Really?
Really?
Sexual violence.
Yes. Sexual violence is huge in women's prisons and in men's prisons. This is not to say, like, you know, like, people in men's prisons are living this high life and, you know, having a great time. I'm just saying that, like, if you look at, you know, like, the way that prisons are, like, if men get nothing, women get less than nothing, you know? So like, you kind of look at it as a spectrum of atrocious to, like, atrocious, 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 atrocious kind of thing. So sexual violence is huge. Contrary to, like, all these, like, media things, the, like, TV and, you know, movies, it's more often perpetrated by staff members than it is by the other prisoners. Other issues that come to mind?
Unhealthy conditions of living.
Yes. Prison conditions are atrocious. There's lack of natural light. There's not being able to, like, control anything about how you live. You know, and then there's the food, which you described so wonderfully, and, like, the lack of vitamins. And this is particularly pernicious, again, when you realize that many people or many women who enter prison often didn't get health care on the outside. And so they come in with all these health care needs, and then prisons aren't equipped to deal or don't want to deal with health care needs in general, and then they really don't want to deal with women's health care needs. So prisons, even though, like, I think something like 5 to 6% of women in prison enter prison pregnant every year, there still aren't facilities to or resources to deal with pregnancy. There aren't resources to deal with, you know, prenatal visits. There aren't resources to deal with breast cancer screenings, cervical cancer screenings, treatment for these specifically female health issues. And 35 states, yes, 35, I was like doing math. I'm like, oh, wait, what's 15? Oh, 15 minus 15. 15 states have legislation that bans or limits shackling women while they're in childbirth. If you don't know what shackling is, it is when you are handcuffed like this, then you have a chain and it goes around your belly, and you have another chain and it shackles your feet together. So you walk around like this. And when you are in labor, 35 states have no legislation saying that you should not be shackled when you're in labor. New York State was like the 7th or 8th state to pass anti-shackling legislation in 2009.
Yeah, super recent.
Yeah, so you would think, like, it's 2012. Why are we even shackling women when they're pregnant or in labor? Or why are we shackling people anyway to begin with? But, you know, like, it's like if you're going to look at atrocious, 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 it's like women who are in labor actually do need to be able to move and spread their legs, you know, to give birth to a baby. And it is not up to the medical staff in the hospital where the woman is taken to say, like, this is when the shackles come off. It's up to the guard that accompanies her to say, like, okay, I'll take the shackles off now. So if the guard wants to go out for a soda, he may decide to, like, prolong having her shackled so that he can go out for a soda or smoke a cigarette or whatever.
And even in places where there is legislation, they shackle you 20 minutes after the birth in most places. And you just gave birth.
I mean, there have been horrific stories of women who've undergone cesarean sections, which, you know, for those of you who don't know, when they, like, cut the baby out of you while handcuffed. Like, where are you going when you're undergoing a C-section? You're not going anywhere. So, like, these are some of the atrocities that, you know, you don't hear about. Other things that come to mind? I'm really quiet. All right, I'm going to run through a few things then. Race. Race is a huge part, as you brought up. There are actually statistics kept by our own Bureau of Justice Statistics, which, you know, I love using because it just shows how flawed and fucked the system is. So according to their most recent statistics, 1 in every 300 black women is or has been incarcerated. 1 in every 704 Latina women is or has been incarcerated. And 1 in every 1,099 white women is or has been incarcerated. So you can see how this is really a system, you know, based on, like, racial control. And again, as Jason and y'all pointed out, it's not necessarily because women of color commit more crimes, but it's because they get policed more, they get surveyed more, and they get caught more. And then when they're at the pretrial arrangements, a study found that in 700,000 cases that were all similarly situated, they actually matched white and black defendants with similar histories and similar charges, and they found that every level, when you're negotiating with the prosecutor, when you're a pupil for the judge, when they decide what kind of bail you get, whites got more consideration than blacks. You know, this is appalling, but unfortunately it's not a surprise. Let's see.
Full sterilization, I know from the 70s, is it still there?
I don't know.
Do you know if there's forced sterilization?
It depends on how you look at it, I guess. I mean, I definitely think that, like, with birth control, who we advertise birth control to it's debatable, but I don't believe there's forced sterilization.
Although you can look at incarcerating women during their entire childbearing years as another form of forced sterilization that's not as... You can't put your finger on it as well as you could when you were, like, you cut something off, you know. So there is, like, this pattern of, like, women get sentenced to longer sentences, and then they come out and they're not, you know, able to have children. And again, when you look at the fact that it's mostly black and brown bodies in those prisons, you can see who's being targeted, you know, for these. And then
when you include forced commitment for people with mental illness and developmental disabilities that get forced into community, there is still forced sterilization legalized in a lot of places still. That there's legal forced sterilization for women with mental illness, depending on what access it is and what type of crazy they decide you are, they get forced sterilized still.
Another issue that we don't think about when we think about women in prison, if we ever think about women in prison, is women in immigrant prisons. You know, so we have to, like, remember that it's not detention where you get to, like, walk out anytime. It's actually prison. You know, it's like you get locked up, you're, you know, behind the door, you've got somebody guarding you, you've got all the same abuses, all the same lack of resources, perhaps even more if you're not a native English speaker, or if they're, like, you know, and women make up approximately 10% of the daily population detained by ICE, so at any given time there's approximately 3,000 women in these immigrant prisons on any given day. So, like, today, tomorrow, you know, there's approximately 3,000 women. And there's been a spike because of the anti-immigration legislation that's been passed and because of increased workplace raids in places where low-income immigrant women work. So they'll be, like, swept up and detained a lot more than they have in the past.
And it's hard. Once you get swept up by ICE, it's hard to find them. Like, yeah. Right? Like, you'd be working with someone, and then you're gone, and you're, like, calling, trying to figure out where they're at, what facility has someone been held, and you don't know. It's really hard. Like, ICE is on... Their families
don't know either.
Right, and you can't get any information.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things, too, is that you're gone, and then also because there are immigration prisons all over the country, and it's a federal system, you could be from New York, and you could be, like, sent to, like, Alabama, you know, where, like, nobody speaks your language, you have no family, you have no support, and what kind of, like, legal work are you going to be able to get done, you know, like, if you're in Alabama and all your support system is in New York, you know, what are you going to be able to get done if you're in Oklahoma and you only speak Fujianese, and you're like, you know, how do I then even plead, how do I even ask for, like, take a shower, you know, if like nobody in that area can speak your language. So these are other things that, like, on top of all the other atrocious conditions you have to contend with if you are in an immigrant prison.
And if you don't speak English, even if it's Spanish, and you would assume that there would be enough Spanish translators at court and that would be happening, it isn't necessarily happening. Mm-hmm. People are going through the entire, like, judicial system without even knowing what's going on, without their attorneys communicating with them, taking pleas to things that are going to get them flagged by ICE without knowing that any of the process has gone by because there wasn't an interpreter there.
Yes. Yes.
And then they get flagged and then no one knows and there's no, like, balance checking on any of that.
You know, like, with secure communities and programs like that, there's been a lot more cooperation between, like, police and the prison system and ICE. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit and how that affects people.
I didn't know there was a lot of cooperation happening.
Sorry, I can talk about it if you want. Mm-hmm. know if you wanted to keep going. We can go back to it.
Yes.
Do you want to give a brief overview?
Yeah. Real brief. Secure Communities is being instituted. It's been instituted in Boston, so that's why we've been fighting it there. So for folks who don't know, it's a national effort really spearheaded by Barack Obama to make it so that essentially all police are functioning as ICE agents in the sense that when they arrest someone, they'll find out their documentation status and they will report anyone who they believe could possibly be undocumented, regardless of what they're arrested for. So even if it's a civil infraction and misdemeanor, which are not deportable offenses, they will report you to ICE, and ICE then has 48 hours to put a retainer on you. And if they choose to, which currently they've chosen to in Massachusetts, they've chosen to in 80% of the cases. And so they hold you, and then you're held wherever, and then you're put to the next spot, and then you are immediately put into deportation proceedings. Whether or not they choose to move forward with the case that you were originally arrested for is up to the DA, so they can end up transferring you back, and you have to then go back and do whatever time you're going to have to do before they then send you to ICE and then you get deported. So what's happening is that police are... So if you go in Texas, there are a number of police forces throughout the state who their police jackets say ICE on top of their actual city and town police name. So they're actually, the partnerships are so directly connected, especially in the border states, southern border states specifically, not in the northern border states, thank you, white supremacy. But so that is, again, Barack Obama's child. This is really his concept. He's been pushing it forward.
I think he deported more people than Bush or anyone else.
Almost twice as many under him than under Bush.
Okay, so now that all these horrifying realities have been thrown at you, let's talk a little resistance, okay? All right, so again, going back in time, and this ties into like some of the work Steps is now currently doing, but going back in time to the late 1980s, or to the 1980s, when people weren't really talking about domestic violence or abuse. You know, it was like that dirty secret that happened over there, you know, and if you were abused, you didn't talk about it. You know, if you fought back and killed your batterer, you know, like courts weren't taking this into consideration, they didn't want to hear it, you know, they only were looking at the really narrow time frame in which, you know, like the killing happened. They weren't looking at like patterns of abuse. They didn't, you know, and women often didn't also know that they were being abused because there was this culture of silence. There wasn't a culture of talking about these kinds of things. So going back to the 1980s, in the women's prison in Marysville, Ohio, a group of women with long to life sentences formed, and they called themselves Looking Inward for Excellence, or the Life Group. And they basically just formed as a support group. They said, we're all doing long sentences. Let's figure out how to get through this. Again, it's that sort of like, let's form some sort of like community and just help us each other out. And they started talking about like why they were there and what had happened. And they started realizing that the majority of them were inside with these long to life sentences for killing their abusers. And so they were like, wait a minute, you know. And this was a process. I'm like streamlining it because, you know, you don't want me to like talk about like 20 years. You know, like... So they started saying, like, wait a minute, like, you know, like, we shouldn't be in here. There's, like, why should we be in prison for the rest of our lives for finally defending ourselves, you know? And so they started a clemency campaign, and they wanted clemency from the governor for their actions. And they said, you know, we shouldn't be in prison. And they contacted the governor's office, and the governor sent an aide and I think his wife to their meeting to meet with them. And they talked about their circumstances and their situations, and, you know, the governor basically agreed to hear their applications. And they didn't just stop among this group. They said, you know what? There's probably other women in this prison who are here for killing their batterers that shouldn't be here. So they started fanning out, and they started going to, like, unit to unit, into the yard, into the mess hall, and any place where they could find other women. And they started talking to them and saying, like, what are you here for? You know, like, you know, do you really think that, like, you deserve to, like, be treated like that by your loved one? You know, it's not your fault. And a lot of times they helped women overcome denial about being abused and helped them understand that they had been abused. And then if they had been abused and might qualify for clemency, where they might be able to find documentation of abuse, you know, like if there were hospital records or police reports or neighbor witnesses, you know, and this led to 18 additional women applying for clemency. So that's 18 other women who might have just sat in their cells and just thought,
you know, I'm a bad person, I killed my loved one, you know, even though this person was beating on me and abusing me, you know, there's still that sense of shame and guilt. And in the end, the governor pardoned or granted clemency to 25 of those women. So 25 women were able to get out, and it was the first mass clemency for women incarcerated for defending themselves against abuse in the history of the U.S. And this made headlines all over. Some newspapers got it, some newspapers didn't, but it reached the women's prison in California, where there was another support group called Convicted Women Against Abuse. Again, it didn't start as like a political group. It started as a support group for women who had been abused and had been sent to prison because they fought back against their abusers. And they looked at that newspaper clipping and they said, you know what, we should do that here. So they wrote a letter to then Governor Pete Wilson and they said, you know, we would like you to come to one of our meetings and like understand our situation, and we would like you to consider clemency for every single woman in the state of California who has been arrested and incarcerated for defending herself, you know, and consider her for clemency. And California is one of those like three strikes and you're out, we lock you up, we throw away the key, we build more prisons even though we're broke. So Wilson declined to meet with them. He declined to open up every single case and look at it to see if everybody qualified for clemency, but he said he would take that letter as a petition for clemency just from the women who had signed it. So it wasn't sort of like the mass, you know, clemency victory, because in the end he granted clemency only to 3 women, denied it to 7, and made no decision whatsoever on 24 of those women. But one of the other results of their clemency campaign is that they drew the attention of outside advocates and lawyers who helped them draft their clemency petitions and helped them gather evidence. And when the governor made his decision or made no decision in so many of those cases, continued to do this kind of work. And they said, you know what, we need to educate the public that there are battered women in prison and that they're, you know, and that they shouldn't be in prison and that they need to be out. So they did educational events, they held rallies, they petitioned for clemency. And since then, 35 additional women have been released because of these efforts. So it's 35 other women that would have just stayed in prison for the rest of their lives. So it's one of the longer-term effects of people on the outside, again, taking leadership and supporting the women on the inside. And I want to end on a sort of cautionary note on how we talk about all these issues facing people inside prisons, and we should not take this as a call to reform the prison system, because the prison system often uses these calls for reform to build bigger, more expansive prison systems that widens the net and takes up, you know, and incarcerates more people. So again, kind of going back into history, in the 1800s, there were no separate women's prisons. Women were just incarcerated, and not very many of them, granted, like, you know, but they were just incarcerated in the men's prison. So they were in the attic, in the cellar, in the cell next door, you know, like in the slop house. You know, but they were just kind of this afterthought. And not only did they not have access to any sort of programming, they were also subject to a lot of sexual abuse by both staff members and the men in the prison. So in the 1870s, the Quakers came in to do, I don't know, whatever Quakers do in the prison, and they were horrified by these conditions. And so they started campaigning for separate prisons for women. They were like, women need a separate prison away from the men. You know, they need to, like, be, you know, guarded by women. There needs to be a matron. And this led to the first women's prison being established in Indiana in 1874. And other states followed suit, and by 1940, 23 states had established some sort of separate facility to hold women specifically. And this led to a drastic increase in women being sent to prison. Because before that, judges would be like, well, you did X, Y, and Z, but do I really want to send you to a prison? Because I know that prisons are such hellholes. I know you're going to suffer. I know you're going to be abused. But then suddenly with the building of these new women's prisons, they were like, oh, so there's a place we can put you now. So this led, again, to an increase. And the prison system had sort of anticipated this. Like in Illinois, when the first separate women's prison had been built, even though only 10 women had ever been incarcerated, you know, on any sort of like given year in Illinois, they built a building that would hold 100 women. And then, of course, the judges started sending women there. So in the next year, like, you know, the women's prison population tripled, and it continued to grow and grow and grow. So, like, again, this is like a way that the prison system kind of, like, just builds, you know, builds on these calls for reform and what people, like, really mean well, but, you know, end up expanding the prison system. So jumping to present day, unless you're like, yeah, that was in the 1800s. In 2006, in good old California, the California Department of Corrections released a report that stated that they found that there were 4,500 women currently incarcerated that didn't need to be in prison. They'd be better off, like, in the community, like, maybe, like, in a drug treatment program if they weren't for a drug crime. They'd be, or, you know, like, you know, some sort of, like, work program or something that would address why they had gone to prison in the first place or what had caused them to commit whatever they'd done that sent them to prison in the first place. We know why they go to prison, you know, but what are the underlying factors, you know, that make it so that they might go to prison? And instead of having a plan to release them, they were like, okay, so we're going to build these new mini prisons. You know, they were called the Female Rehabilitative Community Correction Centers. And they were going to be in these, near these urban areas where many of these women came from. 4,500 new beds, you know, just to incarcerate women. They weren't going to close any of the existing women's prisons or close any of those beds. You know, so basically this would be a way to incarcerate more women, you know. And they weren't going to talk about, like, any of the reasons why women went to prison or anything else. The state legislature rejected their proposal, but in 2007 passed a modified version which called for a quote-unquote female offender reform master plan that supposedly would address the needs particular to the women's prison population, but would not address any of these underlying factors as to why they went to prison, like poverty, racism, you know, the increasing feminization of poverty, mental illness, and at the same time, like, the state legislature continued to slash all the programs on the outside that would have kept women in prison. So, again, this is, like, as a cautionary note, when we think about all these atrocious conditions, we shouldn't think of this as, like, how can we make things better inside, you know, but, like, how can we sort of, like, start chipping away at all these other things that, you know, that cause the prison system to be so massive. Thank you.
So I want to thank all of our speakers, and then I want to open up the floor for people's commentary and questions, and if you have a question or have commentary, just, you know, in some order, just put your hands up and I'll put you on stack and then I'll get to you. So.
I mean, I came a little bit late, but the last speech day, everything works out. But I believe that what we have to try to change is the system, the legal system. They have laws that doesn't seem to work when it comes to women, especially young women, you know, underage. For example, I'm going to tell you a little input of a story. Maybe you could use that to your future in your talk. It's like a little story. I hope you understand. You know, it's maybe this young girl, 14 years old, or 15 or 16, right? Selling herself in the street. The cops know that. Right? But she's young. And they watch her. Then they park the car right next to her. You understand? She comes to the car and she said, are you a cop? No, I'm not a cop. But they knew she was young already. No, I'm not a cop. Come in, you know. She asks again, are you a cop? No, I'm not a cop. She goes in. Takes out $20. She asks him again, are you a cop? No, I'm not. Put the $20 in her hand. Blah! Out of nowhere, they arrest the young girl. They take her to court. They accuse her of prostituting. They put her in prison instead of putting her in a program. She's young. This law that says that you don't have no consent when you're young. She had no consent. She needed help. She was probably asking the cop, the fuel cop, to tell somebody forcing her to do that. But they didn't give her that chance. So now she's facing that. Why the guy they put out there is still probably getting all the girls to come on the back. And the lawyer that she has is only looking for conviction for the judge. Because that's all they care about, conviction. They don't put you in a program. Like you say, there's moms, sisters, cousins. Everybody is in prison. They don't care. Once you're in there, it's like one of my poems that says, you're very alive. It's true. You lose everything. You lose all your rights. Babies born there, when they come out, they don't even know who their mother are because somebody else has them. You think that's fair? But it all comes to this legal system. They want a conviction from every one of us. They want to have us, well, we're already in prison, believe it or not, outside. We're already in prison. but they know that if they keep the woman inside, there will be no more reproduction but the ones they want to reproduce. You understand? Mm-hmm. So as long as they could have control of reproducing people that are not going to accept the injustice, because we know. In talking about prison, he was talking about prison and Attica and all that. Well, I'm going to tell you something about Attica that's not put down in books too much. Attica, the people that rebelled in Attica, they did it for a purpose. That wasn't given to them after that. You know why they gave them? TVs, radios, Walkmans, so they could kill each other for it. Sneakers. They wasn't fighting for that. It was fighting for justice, for, you know, respect, not abuse, no more abuse. But they gave them that because they said, wait a minute, if we give them TVs, radios, and all that, they'll kill each other because not everybody could afford that. So it's like living in the street. That's all they got in there. That's before that, they was educated. That's why they don't let the old ones out until they die. You know why? Because they got so intelligent, they said, wait, we can't bring these guys back anymore once they get out. So we cannot let them go. Let's keep them in there and bring new ones. These young kids, we keep letting them in and out, because they're going to keep going in and out. While the old ones that was educated, they knew that prison wasn't for them. There was revolutionaries, you know. There was all kinds. Young laws. Well, I was a young law, you know. And things like that. So, Attica, to them, yeah, it's a story. They put, oh, they did this and that, but they don't put everything right. They haven't given anything to Attica. They haven't done anything for what happened in Attica. As a matter of fact, they made it worse. Because now they got more control. That's why in prison, you can hang out no more than six. It's like religions. They let everybody have different religions so they could, right, kill each other or hurt each other in prison. They don't want you to get educated. Women suffer every day, not only a rape and all that. They're not supposed to be there, most of them, like you said. Most of them are there convicted for a petty thing. The jail sentence served, even if they were guilty, they only deserve a program. Why they don't build programs instead of prison? The more prison they build, the less people are going to be around. Pretty soon they're going to put bars around everybody's doors. Everybody, that's all they need. They tried once, remember, when they put the bolts and all that? What we're trying to say is the system. We need the system, don't get me wrong. We need, you know, the government, we need everything, but we don't need the corrupt in there. We don't need the violators in there to violate our rights, or every human right. Everybody should have a fair right. Like, for example,
just in the interest of time, I'm going to like ask if there's like any response people on the panel have, and then so other people can have a chance
to speak.
And then if, like, you know, other people don't, we can get back to you. I just want to make sure everybody has a chance to, like, get in there.
That was awesome. Yeah. That's it. Just to actually go back to the first part of your comment, talking about legal reform, especially for women, there's an act that's in the New York State Legislature called the Domestic Violence Survivors Justice Act that's currently pending legislation, and it's being spearheaded by a group called Coalition for Women Prisoners out of the Correctional Association, which is a really amazing advocacy group of formerly incarcerated women and allies. They're basically pushing through this legislation that would allow judges to consider domestic violence when considering sentencing, which right now judges are not allowed to do that. And it would be, you know, kind of moving forward and would be retroactive. So it would be really great for a lot of women who are currently incarcerated who have charges related to domestic violence who were convicted of those charges. So I would just encourage everyone, May 15th is a really big advocacy day up in Albany, and there's going to be a lot of movement around that, but you can check out the Coalition for Women Prisoners website, and there's a lot of really great information that I think can lead you to more information about the Domestic Violence Survivors Justice Act.
Piggybacking on the legal piece thing, because I love the word piggybacking.
Do you want them to agree?
Sure, your call.
Yeah, take it.
I don't want to hold it.
Like a
talking stick.
Yeah.
Well.
So, first off, the murder of Trayvon Martin is a racist, horrific, violent attack of white supremacy, and the what's going on around it is racist reporting and the attack on him and the ways in which this has gone and the reporting has been disastrous. All that acknowledged, the Stand Your Ground laws are more complex than we are necessarily being told about. Stand Your Ground laws, in terms of domestic violence, can be incredibly important, can be a giant piece of self-defense. So in Florida, when they were pushing the Stand Your Ground laws, one of the people who were pushing for it were domestic violence advocates, saying that this makes it so that women who, specifically they're talking about women, but just as a side note, I do work with the GLBT, domestic violence organization, crosses all communities, gay men, domestic violence is expansive. But anyhow, amazing organizing efforts in support of the Stand Your Ground law was pushed by domestic violence advocates because when people fight back against their abusers, it is regularly not in the home. It is regularly not, it's when they are fleeing, it's when they're getting away, it's when you get a space and people are fighting back to survive. And so when we are talking about Trayvon Martin's case and when we're talking about what to do George Zimmerman, that we need to do so with an understanding that the criminal justice system does not exist to serve real justice in any way. And so when we, at least in Massachusetts, people are really focusing on this particular law and getting other people to repeal it. And my understanding is New York is talking about repealing. There's a Stand Your Ground law here that people are working to repeal. But to look at it with more complex lens, that I think one of the things that penal abolition gives us an opportunity to do is to say that all of these things are not as black and white as the justice system or the media wants us to think that it is. And so when we look at the tools and resources that people have, how do we challenge the white supremacist and patriarchal use of so many of these tools while at the same time looking at how people have used them to survive, too? And specifically, the Stand Your Ground bill, I think, is a really interesting one for people to take some time to look at. One of the things, people are trying to pass one in Massachusetts right now, and one of the groups that is coming together are people who are fighting against police brutality and saying, this would be great for us because what we can say is that we feel intimidated by the police. So when we fight back and kill police, we will be able to use the Stand Your Ground bill to defend ourselves against that. It's an outrageous, right, that people are like, how dare you can't kill police, that's a horrific, awful thing for you to do, you can't kill people. But trying to say, like, what is this bill about and who is it set to protect? It is set to protect white people who are going after black and brown people. What are the other ways that it could be used and how? And it kind of shows that the law isn't going to help us in the long term. So in terms of what we are advocating for, how well or not well is the law going to end up helping us? And what are the changes we make that are going? It's just, I think it ends up putting us in a big circle and there's lots of confusing, I don't know what to do. But just, I think our opportunity with panels like this and conversations like this get to do is help us ask more questions and say, who is this helping? Where is this going? Who's funding this? Where's the money? All these different questions that we can look at it all in a more complex way. Just kind of throw out there on the legal end.
No, I think you make a really valid point. And we, in general, just around the criminalization of certain social problems, just the way that we're going to solve things with throwing people in jail. And in the domestic violence movement in general, we historically have all kinds of problems that we've set up. And one of the things is to, like, you know, work really actively about trying to get where we're like, yes, we want everyone to be in jail, we want abusers when they assault to go to jail, we want orders of protection in place, we want all of that to happen. And so we want mandatory arrest laws. We want mandatory arrest. We need all these advocates come in and say, this is what we need, this is what we need to do. And then what we're finding right now in the majority of our misdemeanor cases that we have right now at STEPS are all about women who have cross complaints because their abusers have burned themselves, cut themselves, they have defensive wounds, anything like that, and suddenly both people are getting arrested, both people are going forward, and now that victim is a perpetrator. So she can't go to a domestic violence shelter, she can't get any money from any VAWA-funded programs, and you have, like, in general, like, all this stuff that we were trying to do to protect women, we've now thrown more women in jail over orders of protection, and we've given batterers tools to control them. So, you know, we can come by, we can say, oh, well, you know, she was at my house, now she's been picked up, if she doesn't do what I want her to do, I can have her arrested. And it's like, so there's a lot to be thought about when we're thinking about passing laws and who they're really going to go after, and who it's, because in general, like, and it's definitely the case when we talk about women in the 80s who killed their abusers, I mean, we're coming out of police not responding to neighborhoods where we have people with black and brown people and neighborhoods where there's poverty going on and neighborhoods where you're not going to get a response when you're going to call anyone. So you do have to defend it yourself. You do have to take matters into your own hands. You're not just going to let someone roll on you all the time. And now you're going to be arrested for it.
Just to continue on with that, once, like, if you are a survivor of domestic violence, once you're in the jail, it's further traumatizing to be in jail. Like, I think some people have this misconception that in the women's sections there's only female guards. It's absolutely not true.
Right.
And specifically, if you look at the mental health unit, people who either are, like, a lot of the time when a woman kills her partner in self-defense, one of the first places that she'll go when she gets there is the mental health unit. And if you're on suicide watch there, you can't wear your clothes. You have, like, a hospital gown.
And a pamper.
The showers are public. You have a camera on you when you use the toilets. The first time that, I guess not the first time, one of the times when I was in the mental health unit, I actually went and used the bathroom there because the officers were taking too long to help me go to where the other bathroom was, and I was like, you know, how absurd is it if I just use this toilet right now? Anyway, I'm just going to do it. And they were all like, pee, girl, pee. And I did it, and I'm sitting there on the toilet, and there's, like, a camera on me. And I'm like, it was just so, and I realized that, you know, I needed toilet paper, so I'm going around the corner, and there's this glass window and a little roller with the paper on it, and I'm like, trying to get through, and there's like, you can only get your hand through a certain amount. So if you can think about, you have male officers and female officers, but watching you, maybe making body comments while you're showering, controlling how much toilet paper you have to get. So if you have to take, which, pardon me, then it's like you need to ask someone's permission. How much does that mirror an abusive relationship? When you can eat, when you can go to sleep, the other people that you have to interact with, it's very re-traumatizing. And with the sexual violence that goes on there, you have officers who are in control of, they know where the cameras are. If they want, they can put you in solitary confinement. And it's not necessarily just, like, if you look at sex work or prostitution, like, a lot of the women that go in are there on prostitution charges, or they have had an experience with sex work, and there's this idea, well, you know, I'm used to trading sex for things that I need, so for officers, like, sex for drugs, sex for extra meals, sex for this and that, and on one level, it's like, okay, they're empowered, they're doing their thing, but on another level, there's a power structure there where the officers always are in control of all of the resources, and should you have to, even if the woman feels okay about using her body in that manner, should she have to use her body to get basic human needs? And it's a huge problem. It's really disgraceful. So, sorry. That was it.
Oh, wow. That was my bad. Right. Okay.
So,
So is there somebody else on staff who wants to talk?
There are two people?
Okay.
I just wondered if you guys could talk a little bit about the financial incentives behind the prison system and behind immigration detention, and how it seems like that's a huge obstacle to getting these systems, like to abolish or reform them.
Well, just quickly, I would say a lot of, with the financial incentives, a lot of the problems are that you have entire communities that are based around the prison system. Like, if you go to different, like, to go visit someone upstate, you'll notice that, like, the entire town is built around, like, okay, where are people eating? Where are they sleeping while they're going to visit? Everyone who's in the town is employed in the prison. So if you were to take that away, it's a huge issue, because then you have a lot of people who are out of work, so they're not going to vote for legislation to, you know, reduce the amount of people in prison. So that's, I'm not as much aware of the immigration piece, but that's what I would say about the financial.
I think this is the same thing for immigration detention systems too. I know there's one they're building in Newark right now, Delaney Hall, but like there's a lot of saying like, oh, this is going to bring more jobs to our community.
Yeah.
Well, and it's like, you know, it's a good job as a CO, like as a corrections officer. Like, you get good benefits, you make good money, and oftentimes, like, a lot of, at least at Rikers, a lot of the COs that we see up there in the women's jail are also coming from the same communities where the women being arrested, and so you have this, like, weird internal hatred stuff going on where you have to other yourself, and you have to really put down that person because I'm not like you, and we're really different, and it's really disgraceful because there's lack of opportunities. There's lack of ways to be able to, you know, pay for your stuff, get your kids to school, do what you need to do. And so, yeah, we have a lot. I mean, not to say, like, there's definitely COs that we work with that we like, and they're, like, doing their thing and forming the gospel choirs and, you know, making it work. And then you have COs that are just so horrific and terrible sexual predators, and are in units like the mental observation units because they know they can get away with stuff because women are crazy there, or, you know, whatnot. And it's just, yeah, it's the prison industrial complex. You can make, and, like, prisons make a lot of money for a lot of people.
And there's definitely that. I actually was looking when I was in Rikers the other day. They have vans, and they say they've got, like, the shadow of corrections officers stenciled on the side, and it says, "We protect our own."
Mm. Yeah.
It's just really interesting that they selected that phrase exactly. But it is, like, if there is an issue that comes up, for example, recently there was an issue where a bunch of women reported a specific officer, mm-hmm. and it's this, like, oh, well, now he's going to be pumping gas, which actually in this case was driving a bus. You no longer get contact after being accused of like a sexual advance or some sort of sexual assault against another inmate. If you're an officer, they move you with no inmate contact, so you still get your pension, you still have everything else, but now you're driving the bus instead of, you know. So it's definitely, they protect their own.
And demonized, like, right? Like, when we had, there's someone we had worked with who came, was incarcerated for at least 2 years and came up pregnant. So we know. No, and they tried to blame it on, like, the service providers, which most of us are women, but they tried to blame it on us, like, we were all, like, somehow interacting and impregnating women. But she was, like, completely treated as a leper, sent into protective custody, couldn't come down to any of our events, had been working with us for quite some time, and she was being punished for that, because she was, like, a problem. She was, like, you know, bringing out what goes on in correction institutions, like, yeah, it's
and there's this sort of, it's sort of strange too, because I've noticed the way that I get treated. I get mistaken for an inmate a lot. It just happens. But the way that I'm treated, especially after officers have gotten to see me for a while, they know that I'm speaking with women about sexual assault. And I make it my business because I want them in, like, any kind of interaction or counseling session, I want them to feel free to say, you know, this is my experience, and they don't have to mention the officers' names. But a lot of the time, I walk through the jail, and I know who they are. And it's this, like, kind of weird exchange where the officer assumes maybe that I have that information. And there's definitely, for service providers, depending on how you look, when you go through, you also get profiled in a certain way and not always treated the best. So it's definitely interesting to see both sides of that, because I felt, I know, I think you might have, I think Sarah might have actually been there for this. Sarah also works with us.
Yeah.
But,
for the radio?
No, well, not that one. But going through and having someone say, oh, you know, you have to go through the FBI if you want to get in.
Yeah.
And they're like, do you know what FBI stands for? And I said, fat, bald, Italian. So, and they said, female body inspector. And that was, it was just such, I was like, I cannot believe they just said that. And that's like, and I'm going in as a service provider. So if you can imagine what they're saying to the women, like what kinds of comments you're making about someone's body, what, you know, what's coming out of their mouth, and it's all, the officers are also flirting with each other. Like, it's a very...
Oh my gosh, it's General Hospital.
Yeah, like, if you want to make an amazing reality show, if you could get away with it, it would probably work to shut the system down, I think. Yeah, it's really interesting dynamic, and I think that it definitely comes from the fact that it's like the officers are also spending all day in jail, and at this point a lot of them are people of color as well, so you have, it's just like this, everyone's incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, everyone's spending that time behind bars. So,
and a funny thing to like go back to the cost of incarceration and how much it costs, like, communities and taxpayers and just the soul suckiness of it, is that in New York, we just recently found out for this writing our proposal, we were renewing our funding, is that in New York City, it costs close to $250. Was it $250 a day to incarcerate someone at Rikers Island? It's one of the, like, largest across the nation, because, like, across the nation, I'll say things from, like, 60 to 80%, you know, $60 to $80 a day. It's $250 in New York. Yet, we don't see bails. We don't see, like, ways to afford it. We're like, the whole way it's set up is really, really backwards. And it's really pricey. Like, to run that island the way it's run up there is really expensive.
There's also a great book called The Prison Profiteers. Mm-hmm. That's really good if y'all haven't seen it. Co-edited by Paul Wright, right, from Prison Legal News. It's really well done. I think also in terms of the immigration detention side of things, certainly Corrections Corporation of America and GEO are the two largest. So Corrections Corporation of America and GEO are both they own private prisons, what they do. Corrections Corporation of America is significantly larger than GEO. I don't know if GEO is in the immigrant detention centers or not yet.
Yeah.
They are, okay. They are funded. In case you are like, where do they get their money? How are they supported and funded? You know, certainly a lot of tax dollars go to funding these things, but then also it's major private corporations, investment companies like Fidelity, Wellington, TIA Cref, which is everyone's favorite socially responsible investment company, has millions and millions of dollars in private prison. So they also have a lot of money in Israel, surprise, surprise, connections between the carceral state and Israel. So in terms of looking at finances, there's certainly the private prison side, but then the privatization of all of the services, right? So in Massachusetts, it is not legal to have private-owned prisons, but every single aspect of the prison is privatized. The healthcare is privatized, the food is privatized, the cleaning is privatized, you know, so all the different aspects are. And then the guard unions are outrageous. In Massachusetts, to start as a prison guard is $72,000 a year. That's starting salary. It is not a working class job. It is a upper middle class job. In Massachusetts, prison guards are not predominantly from the same community as prisoners. I know that's true in a lot of places, not in Massachusetts. They are not part of like the working class movement. They've made that very clear. They are very actively choosing to not align themselves with other union organizing efforts. And it's really interesting to watch the union divide between the cops and the prison guards and the firefighters kind of stick together in the service industry, and just like kind of watching, at least in Massachusetts, all of that happening. I know that happens in different places around the country. So the privatization of all the services and pieces, it's scary.
And like, if we just spent a fraction of that money on programming, right, employment opportunities, mental health, like the way that, the, I mean, just a fraction of that, like how different things would look.
Excuse me, I gotta go, right? I want to tell all of you, keep up the good work, you're doing good. But before I go, I would like to listen to what this lady had to do, this young lady. I've been waiting.
I was hoping to continue moderating this discussion and get in Vicky's input on that last question real quick and then move on to her.
So just one quick, like, piggybacking, you know, is also when we talk about finances, we also have to keep in mind that we shouldn't look at prisons as a thing that's built to make money, even though that's a nice side effect, but it's a form of social control. We didn't have mass incarceration until the, you know, the various social justice movements in the 60s and 70s kicked off and really made communities of color and poor people a threat to the system. We didn't have all these prisons proliferating in the South until slavery was abolished. And then suddenly it's like, what do we do with all these free black people? I know, we'll put them in prison. And then we'll use their labor, right? We'll have convict labor to like work in all these jobs. So when we think about prisons, like, yes, it's important to know where the money comes from and where it goes and everything else, but not to think of it as prisons are built solely for that, but they're built to control populations, whether it be communities of color, women, LGBT folks, you know, people that don't fit nicely into like what that, you know, like white sparkly American dream is. So.
Okay. Hi, everybody.
Hey.
Well, I was supposed to be sitting up there today. And I got a little late, and I just wanted to share. I was incarcerated myself. I'm a survivor of domestic violence. And I dealt with the whole system. And thanks to Steps, this beautiful woman right here, I love her so much. She and Steps, oh God, helped me through my situation because I was facing a lot of time and I was acquitted of all charges.
Yeah! Woo!
I just want to say that when you know in your heart, when you believe in yourself, even when you don't, there's people that will help, and I had that, and I was giving up. I was just like saying, forget it, I'll just take it. I just want to finish this, and I stuck it out, and I got a really good result. But I see a lot of women that get afraid to go all the way through because they're being told inside the prison, after you get your third offer, you better take it because if you don't, they're going to go back up on you and stuff like that. I was facing 25 to life. So that's not true. You don't have to take anything. You can just keep going and keep going. But the problem is for the women in the prison, they're limited on the legal research. They're not able to go into the law library and get a lot of information. And when they do get information, it's old information that's not even helpful to their case. So they're stuck. So what I did was I was able to get information from the men's prison and got a lot of information through Steps, and I got a lot of information from outside. But inside Rikers, I wasn't able to get the information that I needed to help me. And I think that that's a big issue because a lot of the women don't even know their rights. They don't know what they can do. They don't know who they can speak to. There's advocates outside. There's many places. I mean, even inside a prison, I wouldn't have known about steps if I wasn't in the mental unit. I would have never known. If I was in the regular population, I would have never even gotten help, and I probably would have took the time. So I just feel that, you know, it's a lot that can be done, and a person like myself that has been inside, that can be right here with you guys right now and speak, just support these people. Like, if you know someone that knows someone or whatever, really try to help, because the women are suffering, the men are suffering, but what the end result is, as me, a parent, my children, they were suffering without me, you know, and I'm thankful that I can sit right here and talk, you know. That's just the thing. I'm just happy to be here. That's it.
Everybody
have a good night.
And you learn.
Yep.
Never to give up.
Never give up.
Never.
You
can't.
Does anyone on the panel have a response or continuation with that? Or?
Okay.
So does anyone else want to ask a question or make a comment?
Sorry. With respect to trying to abolish prisons, I've been wondering about the connection between education programs and that overall aim, because it seems to be a little conflictual in some respects as well. And I was just trying to get your insights on that. And also with respect to the fight to eliminate solitary confinement, for example, as well. So there's with respect to that, by the way, we have an event going on, so if I can apply for that. Okay. On the 5th of May, Scientific Soul Sessions are going to host a mobilizing effort to end solitary confinement for all prisoners, really, starting with Russell Maroon Schultz. So if you can make it at St. Mary's on the 5th of May, just look for Scientific Soul Sessions. But in any case, how that is connected to all that,
Alright, so one of the things that, you know, we need to remember is that, like, while we're, like, looking to abolish prisons, dismantle it brick by brick, or, like, you know, like, wall by wall, is that there's still 2.3 million people in prison. It's not counting people in, like, immigrant prisons either, or, you know, mental health facilities, or, you know, these other prison places. But, you know, just in, like, state and federal prisons alone, there's 2.3 million people. And we're not going to be abolishing prisons tomorrow. So we kind of need to work on this two-tier level where we need to support people inside, knowing they've got concrete needs. You know, they need, you know, like, they need to be out. They need, you know, like, they need, you know, counseling for domestic violence. They need programs. They need education. They need. So you need to, like, look at what can you do to help people survive and maybe thrive when they are able to get out, or even inside if that's possible, while also doing things to not necessarily make the prison system bigger and stronger. Like, you know, that 2006 example of, you know, being like, oh, we'll just build these nicer prisons and maybe we'll put in women's programming is an example of, like, how you can, like, twist that intention. Whereas it's like, well, what can you do to actually give people the tools that they need? You know, knowing that, like, the majority of people in prison are people that are least likely to go to college, you know, or least likely to have a GED or a high school diploma. You know, so bringing in education is huge. Even though, like, you know, like, some people might be like, oh, that's, like, fluffy and liberal, it's like, well, why, but also asking the question, why don't these people have the same types of educational opportunities on the outside? Like, when I went to high school, I went to Hillcrest High School in Jamaica, back when it was one of these, like, was it school-to-prison pipeline high schools, where you go through the, like, the front entrance, and there's guards, there's, like, the metal detector, you put your air, you know, bag to the airport scanner, you know, like, they pat you down, the teachers don't really care. It was mostly a black, brown, and immigrant high school. And out of a class of 400 my senior year, only 40 of us graduated. Like, you know, it's like, what's going on? But then we've got Rikers Island, which is $250 a day per person. Like, what's going on here where it's like, really? Like, we prioritize locking people up than making sure that, like, those 360 kids would have gotten to the point where they could have graduated high school. You know, it's like, so you can see it as, like, you know, like, what are you doing and how are you doing it? And then also, how are you sort of filling this need, which, you know,
in an ideal world, we wouldn't have to, like, go into prisons to have education systems. We wouldn't have prisons, you know, like, we, you know, but, like, people's needs would be met on the outside. But in the meantime, we do have prisons, and we do have these 2.3 million people in prisons, and we do have, you know, and they do have concrete needs. So we need to, like, sort of, like, do that balancing act of, like, you know, what do we, what do people need in order to survive? And then how do we then make sure that we're not building, like, bigger prisons? Like, we're not building, like, the school prison, you know,
that's
down
right,
the block.
Right.
You know, we're not like, oh, we'll just build, like, a school juvenile jail, you know, like, and, like, just incarcerate all those 360 kids that never managed to graduate. So, like, so doing that two-tier level and always being cognizant that, like, you know, what you want, your end goal is abolition, but, like, those steps that you take need to also support people inside.
I think, just in terms of the education piece, just to add, when you are creating education programs, that they're not done in a punitive way. So, for instance, they've tried to create legislation, again, in my state, that mandates you to get a GED before you can get out. That's one of the things. That if you don't have a GED, you have to get a GED before you finish your time. It fortunately hasn't passed, but that is something that liberals jump on, right? Because they're like, yes, we need education in prison. Absolutely. Programming it all. And then the response is it'll force them to put the programming in, right? The idea is that it'll force the DOC to put programming in, but it is all punitive on prisoners, right? Do we need more education on, or any programming for prisoners that's going to be punitive? So I think the answer there is no. So whenever you are looking at the type of programs that you want to be pushing forward, like, is it about giving power to prisoners through their education, or is it about punishing people for not taking part in programming? And so I think that that part, those two pieces kind of go together. And then the same thing around ending solitary confinement in Maine. There was a big fight to end solitary confinement in Maine, and it started off really bad at the very beginning, where people were only working to end solitary confinement for people with mental illness, and there was no critique of it in a larger sense. And so a lot of folks said, no, we're not supporting it. And then it changed, right? So people came together and said, no, we need it to be reaching more people, and we need to follow the UN's definition that anything over 30 days is torture. And so we won. And so the fight there has been amazing. The victories that are coming are amazing in terms of what's happening in Maine, because people were able to say, we're not going to leave people behind in this. And so I think that's one of the key things, too, is that you're not making changes that are going to end up hurting other people. So that it's not like, we're doing this for people with mental illness, and then legislators can be like, I already dealt with that. I don't have to talk about solitary confinement anymore. We dealt with that last time. So all these other people are doing time in solitary without anyone paying attention. So it's about winning for everyone as much as possible.
One other thing I was going to mention is that before any system can be torn down, there has to be some place for people with mental illness to go, because our way of handling like homelessness or mental illness is to just incarcerate people. And when you see a lot of the women, like you said you had the experience of being in the mental health unit, some people that are there will even go with their friends out of solidarity, or they'll go there because they think it's safer for them. But then there's people who legitimately cannot exist without a routine. Like, it's helpful for them to say, okay, now someone's telling me when to eat, now someone's telling me go to the bathroom, whatever it is. And they need that structure, and our solution, instead of having inpatient programs, is to just send people to jail. And one of the things that was so sad that I was seeing a lot while working there was people who, when they were in, they would get stabilized on their meds. Maybe they couldn't read, so they didn't know that their medication was, you have to take it whatever time. So they would have medication time, they'd get their meds, they'd become stable, and I would see a totally different person that was very competent, could live on their own with a little bit of prompting, but then they get out and either can't read how much medicine they're supposed to be having, don't remember when to take it, or can't afford it, and they end up right back again. And when they come in, it's like they're home. Like, they see their friends, they feel loved there, they have counselors who know them. All of those sorts of things make jail a lot like a mental health program that's really, really bad, and but something that's necessary. So until we address that, that's also going to be a huge issue.
And those guards, they need to be educated on how to deal with inmates because they don't know, even when it's a person with mental health issues, even a regular person, a person that's never been to jail, you know, that comes in, you put them in this cage, and then it's like, oh, yeah, this person's here for that, and they get scrutinized instantly, and it's not fair because that puts you right out there. That puts you, like, in the spotlight for the other inmates to come in, and, well, they're like, okay, well, who is she? And they start talking about your situation. The correctional officers are not trained properly at all.
Can you speak a little bit about the process of getting from the mental health unit to another unit? Like, what kinds of things you had to go through?
I basically went from there to the ITU, which was a program, which it was still a mental health unit, but it was more structured than the first unit that I was in, because the first unit was just, I mean, they're just going crazy and just doing all kinds of things. I would see chairs being thrown and tables rolling and phones ripped off the wall, and that wasn't something for a person like me to be in, but because of my situation and because of what I was there for, they felt that's exactly where I needed to be. And me going into another unit, it wasn't difficult for me because I was told by one of the inmates to speak to a doctor that came down to see me, and instantly he just took me in because he saw something in me. And he was like, okay, now you don't belong here, you come with me. And that's why I went to another unit. But what a lot of them go through is, if you get into a fight, you're going to go into the bin, you get locked up into the bin, and you go into population. And that's not good for a lot of those women because, again, there's a lot of inmates that it's like a revolving door for them, so they're famous. They come in there, everybody knows who they are, so it's like the guards don't even let them, they just let them do whatever they want. So if I'm one of the popular inmates and you come in and you're new and I don't like you, the guard will just sit back and just let me taunt you all day long because that's what they want to do. It's like, whatever, as long as I don't kill you, as long as I don't hurt you, I can say whatever I want to you, I can degrade you, you know, I can go in the shower and fill you up if I want to, nobody's going to do anything because I'm popular, I'm famous in jail. So for me, that wasn't at all where I wanted to be. So my thing was to stay as low key as possible and out of the spotlight because I felt, you know, I'm not here for this and I don't know how long I'm going to have to be here. But as while I'm here, I want to maintain. And like I said, it's very hard. And those guards are not, they don't know what to do when it comes to people. They have no people skills. And how can you work around so many people when you don't even have skills to work with people? You don't even know how to talk to a person. You know, it's very hard. But you learn to adapt because you have to. You know, many times I felt like I wanted to just go off on a few of the officers and even some of the inmates, but then my freedom was more important and my good record in there was more important to me because I don't want to look like everyone else. I want to stand out. So that way, when I go to court, they see that this is a good person. She doesn't belong here. Let her go.
Yeah, and I think that's something that's really important to honor, just the way that, just like in a domestic violence relationship, sometimes you have to keep your mouth shut because that's what's going to make you survive. Like, people say, oh, well, you know, why didn't you, you know, do X, Y, and Z? And it's like, sometimes to not do anything, you have to be so much stronger.
Yeah. And then sometimes you have to do something because then you just keep falling right into the hole, and the deeper you fall into that hole, then there's no way for you to pull yourself out if you don't have anyone to pull yourself out. You're stuck. So, you know, it's just, they need to educate those guys. There's some that are fine. You have it. But I feel that from my experience, at least 80% of them were still not educated on how to deal with that.
So we're going to move on to the next person unstuck. And I just want to remind everybody we're going to try to get through like any questions that everybody has in a full response in the panel. Just everybody who's speaking, try to keep it really brief and to the point now because it's getting towards the end of the panel. We want to make sure that everybody gets to get in there. So I
do have a question. This is not an issue I follow closely, so maybe I just don't understand what you mean. But you guys have all talked about the need to abolish the prison system because there are many, many people who are there because they're victims of an unjust system or because they would be better suited to be put to a rehab center or a mental health facility, that they themselves are victims. But what about the people who act? If you abolish the prison system, what do you do with the serial killers and the rapists and the people who genuinely are dangerous, genuinely owe a debt to society because they deprive someone else of their life or someone else of their body liberty? I mean, what do you do with those people if you don't have a prison system?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, okay, so I don't think that there's, like, I don't know if everyone has any be-all and all answer to that, but I was living in South Africa for a little while, and I ran into an anarchist community. They wasn't call themselves an anarchist community, but it was just a group of people that when there was a problem, you know, everyone got together and discussed it. Like, it was everyone who wanted to be there and make a decision about it discussed it. And there was an instance where two young children had been sexually assaulted by an older man that was in the community. And everyone sat down very calmly, and they decided, you know, what they were going to do about it. And these children actually died from their injuries from the sexual assault. And they, after, like, the community decided what they wanted to do, they stormed the supermarket where he worked, and they actually hung him in the supermarket. And it's like, you get to this point where you're like, how did anyone, like, who ever has the right to decide whether they're going to kill another person, whether they're going to confine another person, like, what you're going to do about it? And I don't think that there are any easy answers to something like that, because...
But I'm not actually asking what is the right answer. I'm saying if you guys are advocating dismantling the system, what do you advocate putting in its place? What is your answer to that question?
The community... This is totally my opinion. I'm totally...
That's all about Michelle right here.
Let the community, like... Let the community of people where that person is from decide. Like, right now, you have people who have computers who can take off of work, who can come and be the jury, who have the time and the money to do that, deciding the fate of people who don't necessarily have any of those things. You have people, for example, from white communities deciding the fate of people from black communities when they have no idea of what they've been through or what those current issues are. So I would say, like, you get into smaller systems, like, break it down. Don't try to have one overarching thing.
But if you start breaking it apart, how do you ensure that people who commit equal crimes have an equal punishment? I mean, what if you have one community where it's a very conservative, very religious community, so their particular morals are that if an 18-year-old girl goes out and have sex, she should be confined. Whereas in another community, they're much more permissive, and it all depends on where you happen to live. How do you ensure
that's cultural fair? Competency, though. No one ensures that it's fair. The communities ensure, like, because in some cultures, there's different ages for things. Like, it's where you're from.
But in Afghanistan, it's appropriate.
I'm sorry. There's like a conversation happening here, which is like cool. But can I ask that other people on the panel get to respond to the original question?
Sorry, I'm
just trying to moderate pretty tightly now because it's like getting towards the end of the evening.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things too is like talking about like building safety. So we're not saying like I'm assuming that none of us are saying. I'm not saying. I'm assuming that you all are not saying like we're just gonna like dismantle the prisons and it's every person for themselves and like we live in Mad Max world, right? Like we're not saying that. Like so part of that, the flip side of that is like building safety and like accountability, right? So like it's like, you know, like communities talking and actually forming communities. We have this like very loose definition of communities, but like, you know, like my definition of community might be different than yours and yours and yours and yours, but like actually taking responsibility for other people's safety. So I mean there have been historical and present day organizing in which people have tried to like to confront violence without actually having to rely on policing and prison systems. So, like, there are groups that, like, do, like, work around sexual assault, you know, without then, like, calling in the system. Is it perfect? No. But it's also, like, and it, again, it's, like, tailor-made because there's not a one-size-fits-all problem or solution to the problem. You know, like, you can't take away the system that, like, you know, like, has existed for hundreds of years and, like, you know, now has 2.3 million people in it and expect to put something similar in its place that's not also going to be a system of control. You know, so it might be, like, you know, like, if I assault you, it might be that, like, we, you know, like, our community sit down and, like, we talk it out. You know, however, if, like, you know, like, if it's something greater, it might be, there might be some other, you know, mechanism that deals with it. And, again, it's community by community. So a couple of examples. In the late 1980s in East Harlem, there was people in the neighborhood realized they couldn't call the police when there was domestic violence. So what they did instead was when somebody was abusing their partner, they would actually go to that person's house and basically physically move in to that house to be like, we are watching you. Like, they didn't live there forever. They lived there for a few days, but it put the abuser on notice that this was no longer the, like, behind closed doors thing, you know, and it basically made just more of a community issue. So the person who was being abused now knew that you could go knock on the neighbor's door and be like, I need help. The person who was doing the abusing was like, I can't do this. Again, it's like that, like, you know, like, making it so that it's not just, like, the individual problem where it's like, do I call the police on my loved one, or do I keep putting up with this? Like, there are other options for safety. You know, there are people who work around, like, like, rape in the streets. Like, again, like, you know, like, starting in the 1970s in Boston, where women were being, black women were being raped and murdered and found in the streets, and the police refused to do anything about this because they were like, oh, they must have been prostitutes, you know. And at the same time, when white women were being raped and left on the streets, the police immediately acted on this. The people in that neighborhood formed what they called the Dorchester Greenlight Project, which is that every house that agreed to be part of this project underwent an orientation. They were, like, trained on safety and conflict resolution and, you know, conflict de-escalation. And then they were given a green light bulb to put on the porch of their house. And when they were home, they turned the light on and there was a green light. So if somebody was walking down the street and they felt unsafe for whatever reason, you know, like, whether there was a real threat or, you know, just a perceived threat, they could go to one of these houses with a green light bulb and knock on the door and be like, I don't feel safe. And they would get to go in, you know, call somebody or just, like, be in a place that was more safe than being out on the street by themselves. Like, call somebody to come pick them up or to come walk them home. But again, it was a way that the community got involved in safety because this was, this was an instance in which the police were not willing to do anything. They were like, they're black people. It doesn't matter. So there are ways that people have organized around safety, and we can look at these models. And even today in, in Brooklyn, you know, by the library, when there was a rash of sexual assault on women walking home from the subway, a group of men actually took it upon themselves to say, you know what, we don't want this happening in our neighborhood. And they would stand around by the subways, and if a lone woman came out, they'd be like, do you need an escort home? Because we realize there's been a rash of sexual assault. It wasn't just the women that they knew. It was, you know, women that were by themselves. And they'd say, you know what, we will walk you to your door to make sure nothing happens. So, you know, again, these are, like, lessons that we can take. And it's not, like, a one-size-fits-all. So, like, what works, you know, what worked in, like, the late 1980s in Harlem might not work so well, you know, in Boston today, you know, and it might not work so well in, like, South Africa. But we can kind of, like, look at what people have done and start drawing inspiration to, like, start forming our own models of what do we do to keep ourselves and our loved ones and our communities safe.
In terms of thinking about murder and serial killers, one thing I feel like we as a culture have a cultural obsession with serial killers, but they're very few. At the most liberal number I've seen is that at any given time there's as many as 50 serial killers that exist. And I've seen this for the U.S. and Europe together combined. So in terms of who we are thinking about in terms of serial killers, if we needed to confine 50 people, I think we could figure out a way that could be done if that was what we needed to do in a way that made sense. I don't believe in punishment, so I'm not willing or interested in punishing anyone for anything. For myself as a Unitarian Universalist, as a faith leader, that goes against my theology. I don't believe in punishment. I don't think that that should happen. I don't think that that's how justice can come about. So in terms of, like, I don't think people should be punished for their actions, but the accountability and transformative justice really echoed, as you were talking about sexual violence and others. There's an organization called Generation 5 in California that does amazing work around ending child sexual abuse in 5 generations. And their work that they are doing, and there's a book here, I've seen it, Revolution Starts at Home, Addressing Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault in Activist Communities, I think is expansive and beyond just activist communities, but can give, as you were just saying, all of these for our communities. But I also think the idea of murder needs... Here's a real unpopular thing to put out there. One thing is, most people who kill people are only going to kill one person. It is a crime of passion. It is only going to happen once. Their intention is not to go out and kill multiple people. Not only are they not serial killers, but the instance in which murder occurred, there is a whole context around it that needs to be looked at and examined. And transformative justice and what Quakers and others have called restorative justice has actually been more effective in the more violent offenses. It's less effective in the more minor offenses, but has been shown specifically in Canada, where it's really used a lot, that it's in cases of murder and rape where restorative justice, which is not my favorite term, I prefer transformative justice, but has actually worked and where people feel safer and feel like there's some sort of justice coming out of it rather than simple confinement, and where people who have caused harm actually have some real accountability, because being locked up isn't accountability. No one's being held account for anything. They're simply being locked up. And then it's, you know, there's a giant amount of resources being put into them being locked up, and people who are survivors often get no resources to be part of survivors. So I think putting money into different places and actually creating transformation would be amazing. And then one real quick thing is that there's lots of murder that we don't care about. Soldiers kill people every single day, and we're like, there's no consequences for them because it's war. They're killing the right people. And so I think when we think of who should be held accountable for what, it is much more complex than taking someone's life. People take people's lives all the time. And the majority also rape. The FBI says themselves, 14 out of 15 rapists will never see a day in jail. So prisons and jails already aren't making us safer. And if I will say, if I had to make a choice, if the choice was we could let everyone out today or it stays the way it is forever, I would choose to let everyone out today. I know that that sounds ridiculous, but if those were the only choices, that is the choice I would make. I think that there's more bad happens by keeping people confined than not.
I know, because I've been... that was awesome. And I also, before we get to the hand, I'm really briefly going to step out of the role of moderator and note that there's a huge body of literature on transformative justice. And on the effectiveness of transformative justice. And if you look at the rate of recidivism in prison and the number of people that, for whatever crime they were in prison for, they're back in prison again a year later, a couple of months later, 2 years later, it's like, it's pretty documented that transformative justice is a more effective way of dealing with what we consider crimes in our society than the current prison system. So, like, looking at that as an option in the abolitionist spectrum is, like, definitely something to go for. And I definitely want to, like, invite you to, like, continue this conversation after the panel with, like, all of us. I'm sure everybody's down with that. And then we can move on to Olivia. And then I want to check before we get to Olivia if there's other people on staff, just so we have an idea of who wants to talk, like, how many people are going to want to talk. So, 1, 2, is there anybody else? No? Okay. So, Olivia.
2 things in regard to your question or comments. You were talking about serial killers, rapists, pedophiles, stuff like that. Oftentimes, when these people go to jail, they actually do end up being taken out by fellow inmates. Mostly, it's, again, it's a community. It's a single community inside for themselves to be judging them and taking them out. So, what's the difference between them being inside and outside? That's one thing. Second thing, serial killers. A lot of people in the psych community don't think that they should be put down. A lot of people don't think that they should be put into prisons.
currently what our jail system deems as being mentally unstable is if you don't know that you didn't do the right thing. There are, have been some serial killers who know that they did the wrong thing and they just don't care. That doesn't mean that they're not crazy. That just means that they don't fall into the definition of crazy, and they have been put they have been given lethal injection, the final injection. And a lot of people think that that is the wrong thing, that that was not the correct way of handling that. A lot of people think that there are better ways. They deserved care. They deserved study, honestly. Yeah.
Did you have a question? Or
no, that was it. I just wanted to throw that in.
Okay, cool. And so then all the way in the back?
Oh. Yeah, well, first of all, I wanted to thank you for such an excellent panel. I learned so much from what everybody had to say, from your unique perspectives, and I guess, you know, you would conclude that the prison system as it exists is not about rehabilitation, it's about crowd control and punishment, and I would like to learn more. It feels like what you put out tonight was just sort of just like an opening into a very, very dark world, like how do immigrant prisons operate, when they're so marginalized in society, and just how prisons mirror societies, problems in a more extreme degree. And also I would just frame maybe prisons are the serial killers, and that corporations are sort of operate on that logic of you know, not caring about life and what happens to it. And also that you're talking about CEOs and other acting in very predatory, rapist ways. Maybe they're the mentally ill who should perhaps be kept from committing further harm. But I was also interested in how these things are being reported. You said in very patriarchal, racist ways, if at all. And that just you as people who are putting together information in books. How you see yourselves in that terrain? You said on one hand you have a clear call to abolish prisons and call for abolition. On the other hand, you're pointing out this very important trend of like good intentions being twisted around and building the better prison society, police state, instead of, you know, leading to actual empowerment. So what would you suggest for someone seeking more information and also for wanting to empower prisoners and hearing their voices heard louder? I guess what talking points or guidelines or you know, that's not a very broad question, sorry, I'm going to stress you out after everything you've done, but like to think with more clarity on the subject and more compassion on the subject. Yeah, what resources would you suggest to follow up from here, since we have to kind of go soon?
Well, Priya, you totally asked the perfect question, because we have, right on the panel, we have books. Books in the bookstore. So, and we have panelists here who are definitely really equipped to talk about books that they've written about the prison system. So, great wrap-up question for this event.
Okay, so there are books. There are some books about prison on there, as you can see. So if you're going to be talking about like sort of like mass incarceration, there's The New Jim Crow, which is right there, the one with the hands. The book that I wrote specifically about resistance and organizing in women's prisons is Resistance Behind Bars, with that awesome illustration. I'm like, I cannot talk right anymore. Which is also, you know, the same woman who was in prison and is now out also did those two beautiful framed pieces up there as part of the prisoner art show. There's a book next to The New Jim Crow. Can one of you hold up that book, please? Called Captive Genders, which is an amazing anthology of the trans experience in prison. You know, and it's really like the first sort of accessible book, specifically looking at the trans experience in prison, because we don't hear a lot about anything about prison that's not like sort of like from the straight male perspective. So that's why I point that out. And then there are a couple of other books. Angela Davis is always really good as a sort of like 101 breakdown as to like prisons and social control. And then all the other benefits the prison system reaps, like the financial aspects and everything else that kind of comes along with when you build a system that incarcerates over 2.3 million people. And another book of women's stories called Inside This Place, Not Of It, which is that yellow book, right, by The New Jim Crow. And then Jason has a piece in
What is the title of that?
Why Are Faggots So Afraid of Faggots?
Why Are Faggots So Afraid of Faggots? About his experience in prison.
I didn't get to read it, so I'm going to let you.
I don't actually have anything to add. You can look at it. You should buy the book. Buy all the books.
And then when you're done, you can donate them to Books Through Bars.
Yeah.
I would say, like, totally plugging my own project right now, but the Empower Rikers Residence Book Project is, I've been hooking people up with pen pals as well, and sometimes just hearing from someone who's had the experience, like, the ladies really enjoy writing back and forth to people, and it's not always, like, going to become intimate right away, but you really can establish a relationship, and just, like you were saying about getting a letter and having someone know that you know, someone's out there thinking about them, you can ask them directly about what their experiences are, and it's healing for them to be able to know that someone cares and put it out there.
What's your
website?
The
Facebook is Empower Rikers Residence Book Project, or you can just send an email to, we have flyers. We do. I'll give you a flyer. Yeah, let me hand those out. So, yeah, here. Did you have
any? Was right. Oh, they were up.
Oh,
all right.
Hey!
So, I just would like to invite everybody who's here, now that we're wrapping up, if you want to ask any more questions of the panelists, to stay around, kick it, and talk to everybody. I'm sorry, I'm offering up all the time. I hope you don't mind.
And thank you for coming out.
Yeah,
I know it's Friday
much.
Evening. Yeah, it's today, so thank you so much.
And in addition to thanking y'all for coming out tonight, I again want to encourage everybody to come to the closing party next week on the 26th. It's going to be really fun. It's a Thursday night, so you don't have to sacrifice your Friday night. You can still go out Friday night and get wild, and come out Thursday night and get wild over here and bid on some prisoner art. And there's going to be some performances and some refreshments and some art for sale, as well as prints of the pieces that will also be available for sale. So please come out and show your support of the prisoner artists who have their work up on the walls here. And thank you so much all the panelists.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And tomorrow here, Dean Spade is speaking about his book, Normal Life, which is looks at, again, really like trans law and the problem with housing, as you would say. The hate crimes legislation and the state and the role the state plays in using the prison industrial complex to create trans identities in particular ways. It's really good. The book is around here somewhere, Normal Life. It's really great. It's a great book. And Dean's great, founder of Sylvia Rivera Law Project. He does amazing work with low-income trans folks and folks of color. A lot around the prison industrial complex, but also around like welfare and other poverty law pieces. Tomorrow night. I don't know what time. People who work here will probably know.
Seven.
There you go. Seven. So seven tomorrow. You could spend your whole weekend here.
Well, thank you.